Everywhere I go today, people are talking. They're talking about the Loose Week tapes. Seems like everybody wants to know. Sonny, what are the Loose Week tapes? That's the question I hear most often. Well, ladies, I'm going to lay it on you. A Loose Week tape, and I want you to know that I am talking about recording tapes. This is not about some tape worms loose in your hair or sticking things to each other with masking or scotch or duct tape. A Loose Week tape is an audio collage. More technically, a Loose Week tape is an audio collage of the Loose Week variety, originally made on recording tape. You got that? A Loose Week tape is an audio collage of the Loose Week variety, originally recorded on tape. And these tapes, the very first ever Loose Wigs ever conceived and produced in the 5,000-year history of civilization, were made around the turn of the century, baby. Not like the wheel, they did not first come from Sumer. Don't you know I made them in Vermont, and I made them for all my friends, and I made them for myself. And not just, you know, like art for art's sake, I made them for myself to listen to over and over. We want to consider the element of art. Art, you dig, is part of the Loose Wig, maybe even one of its key elements, along with the other key elements like magnetic tape and the little plastic cassette holders. But these Loose Wig tapes, or so-called audio collages, are not like the art that gets hung up in museums. I don't want to get hung up in museums. Like what sometimes happens to art, the Loose Wigs have been framed. At first, framed on magnetic tape, and now we're bringing them up to date and presenting them for the first time in digital format. Dig. Each of these tapes, or as we call them, wigs, has its own character. You'll soon find out. There should be warnings on some of them, but so far, no warnings. They are not rated. You just have to dig it for yourself, baby. Some of the wigs are loose but short, just side one and side two of an audio cassette. Some are like double wigs. For example, Loose Wigs 7, 8, and 9 each have sides 1, 2, 3, and 4, each on two cassettes per wig. Conceptually, where it's at is that some of these wigs are worlds apart from each other. You know, like they say, you can't put on the same wig twice, baby. And it won't do much good to think too much about it. Best to just get in the water, relax, and float downstream. Or, as the case may be, just put on the wig and be cool. A very wise man once said, "It is easier for a rich man to pass through the eye of a needle than for a camel to enter the kingdom of the heavens." Some of these wigs are serious, really serious, some heavy shit, and some are sort of full of shit. Some are especially silly, and some are silly as well as funny, and also maybe embarrassing. Some are proportionately boring as well as embarrassing, as I recall. And there are lots of jokes and music, too, and some stories that maybe you never, ever heard, ever, in life or on recording either. What's in and on these Loose Wig tapes, like all great art, or maybe like more like bowel movements, could not be expressed in any other way. So it's not my fault. The Loose Wigs were like Taoism or something. You dig it? Just get on board and go with the flow, baby. Now's the time for you to get the message, and it's time for me to hang up the phone. So I sincerely hope that you will enjoy the Loose Wig tapes. On this sorrowful occasion, I'd like to present Loose Wig 1, Side 1.
You're hearing the sounds Quincy Milo saw. He's crying a little bit. That's right. You know any complaining songs? Songs about the hard times, Quincy. Yeah, well, that was Quincy. In the background, you hear Lucas playing the organ. Now you're going to hear a wild story about Mark and Miles.
All right. This is a story called Fatty and the Earwig. Once there was an ant called Fatty. He had a very, very fat waist and a 3-inch head. And Fatty was as fat as a 2-story building sideways and as tall as Eiffel Tower. But he was very bad. And Fatty acted like he could conquer the world. But Fatty had one enemy, the Earwig. And Fatty and the Earwig were fighting each other. but the earwig had horns. Everybody was rooting for the earwig, even though he was so gross. And one day they met face to face. Then Fatty said, "Oh yeah, you are the tiniest earwig in the world. I've heard about you." "I want to have a fight with you," said the earwig. "Ha ha ha! But I have a partner." "How come you are laughing?" "I just have a disease." "Oh well, there's my partner flying." Fatty looked in earwig, and the earwig caught him. "Made ya look," said Earwig. Then Earwig put Fatty in a tree and said, "I really did not have a partner." And the tree that the Earwig put Fatty in was 8,000 feet tall, so Fatty could not get out. Then Earwig plunged his horns into Fatty, and Fatty said, "I didn't know bugs were so strong these days." So Earwig kept on plunging his horns into Earwig until blood was squirting everywhere, until the blood set Fatty free, and they both ate each other up, and even now you may still be breathing them in and out. The end! Right, if not, you know. Hope you heard it, good.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like you to meet Shorty Pettistine, who is one of the up-and-coming jazz French trumpeters, do they call him, Oscar?
No, man, I blow French horn.
Would you get a little, just a...
Yeah, I blow French horn.
Get a little closer to the microphone.
Yeah.
Okay, a little closer, Oscar.
French horn, man.
Uh-huh. French horn.
Yeah.
And what do they call you, a French hornist?
Well, you know, like I blow horn, man.
Would you speak up a little bit, Oscar?
I blow horn, man.
Yeah. Fine. And tell me, how do you like Dixieland, Oscar?
Well, I mean, you know.
Well, what about, would you say, Tchaikovsky?
Well, yeah, man.
You don't, man, you know.
Like, I mean, he grows on me, you know. Man, I mean, I think more like, you know, a Bartok scene or... Some bit like that, man. Because I mean, I'm more swinging. You know?
Well, how would you compare the kind of music you play with? How would you compare that with art? You know, what kind of art?
Man,
artistic.
I think art blows the most. I mean,
you do.
He came with a band about 3 years ago, man. And he was a real, small town cat. And I mean, he was swinging, man, but he was a small town cat.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, he started to blow with us, and it was a real nut.
And who are you appearing with currently now here in San Francisco?
Well, man, I'm on the show with Stan. You know,
Stan.
My combo, and we're blowing with on the same stand with Stan.
And how are the crowds receiving you down there? They like it.
Well, I mean, they come, man.
Step a little closer to the microphone.
They come, man.
A little louder, please.
Yeah, well,
we want the audience to hear everything you have to say.
Cool. Yeah.
See, that's a mighty good drum, what do you call that, riff?
Well, you know, go on, man.
Now, what are your plans for the future, Oscar?
I'm here, and I mean, I've met a swinging group here. I like Frisco the most, man, because, I mean, the town jumps, you know? I mean, there are a lot of scenes, man, and so, I mean, it's like that, you know?
Uh-huh. What would you advise a young artist, a young musician to do? Would you advise him to get an academic education or strive immediately for self-expression?
Well, man, I mean, I'm a musician, again. I mean, to me, the most important thing is, you should blow, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I tried to make it at Juilliard, man, and... it's a real bad scene, you know, man. I mean, it's a bad scene,
Bad scene?
Yeah, man. I mean, it's not, you know, like nothing's happening, you know? I
mean,
the cats don't blow. No,
they don't have any
happened.
Classes
no,
up
man,
there?
Nothing, no, man. Nothing's happening. No, man.
Well, I was sure that there was something happening up there in Juilliard.
Well,
they have classes.
Sure, they have classes, man.
They have some very fine professors' music.
But they're too far out, man. They're on this Schoenberg bit and job like that. And, I mean, it doesn't swing, you know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, if a cat wants to blow and he wants to blow, and then he's got to have a scene where he can blow. And
yes, well, that would apply. That would apply to the artists that are playing horns and wind instruments. So they would have to blow. What about those who, for example, are playing string instruments? Or would you say that? How's the picture there?
Well, I mean, you know, it's pretty much all the same, man. A blow is like an instrument, you know.
Blow is like an instrument. Well, perhaps there's some verbal communication that we don't seem to be getting across. How do you say blow is like an instrument?
Well, man, I mean, don't hang me, you know. I mean, like, I didn't want to fall up here in the first place, man. I mean, this is a big thug because, I mean, the manager of the band, man.
Well,
I mean,
all right, well,
I can't make it, man.
Take it easy,
Oz. Much. I mean,
look,
you know?
Oscar, okay, thanks. You just go over there and sit down with Pops, and we'll listen to the music.
Cool with my books and records at night in my college room. I read the Sunday comics on a Riverside Drive park bench. It was pleasant. It was an early moment of mine when reading the funnies on a bench was synonymous, like an idea with baby carriages and maids and mothers. And I've since learned that they'll hide machine guns in baby carriages. Who put suspicion in? What was the name of that bum who stole the housewife steaming pie from her kitchen windowsill? In America, the idea of going to college is just like the idea of prosperity is just around the corner. It's supposed to solve something, or everything, or something, because all you have to do is learn what they taught, and then everything else was going to be handled. Instead of that, just like prosperity that was never around the corner, but a couple miles at least, and false prosperity, going to college by acquainting me with all the mad elements of life, such as sensibilities, books, arts, histories of madness, and fashion, has not only made it impossible for me to learn simple tricks of how to earn a living, but has deprived me of my one-time innocent belief in my own thoughts that used to make me handle my own destiny. In those days, I must have been happy. To have such memories of it now, to be able, in fact, to save one memory out of it that wasn't buried like all my happy moments that are now buried the moment they spring up. So I don't remember a thing the next day, and I'm only ready to face new sorrow. In those days, I must have been a regular student, wandering in thoughts among shops and windows, like in Poe or Melville. Here's some of the letters prepared under the moon and mailed in love through these immensities and impossibilities of the land of his birth. Dear Cody, no, it makes no difference now, Lester Young's course of You Can Count on Me, 1930. Yes, Lester used to blow like a son of a bitch. Time to say so, as in Chicago we saw the children of the modern jazz night blowing their horns and instruments with belief. It was Lester started it all, the gloomy, saintly, serious goof was behind the history of modern jazz, and this generation, like Lewis is, Bird his to come and be, his fame and his smoothness as lost as Maurice Chevalier in a stage door poster, his drape, his drooping melancholy disposition in the sidewalk, in the door, his pork pie hat at sessions all over the country from Kansas City to the Apple and back to L.A. They called him pork pie because he wore that gone hat and blowing it. What door-standing influence has Cody gained from this cultural master of his generation? What mysteries as well as masteries? What styles, sorrows, collars, removal of collars, removal of lapels, crepe sole shoes, the beauty goof. And one night I saw Lester in a reverie on the stand make such faces in his thoughts as the audience of watchers, that the sneer, the twitch that Billie Holiday has too, that compassion for the dead, those poor little musicians in Chicago, their love of Lester, early heroisms in a room, records of Lester, early count, suits hanging in the closet, tanned evenings at ballrooms, the great tenor solo in the shoeshine jukebox. You can hear Lester blow from L.A. to Boston, Frisco to New York, Seattle to Philly, Kansas City, Missouri, 1935-40, Lester has a hold of the generation. In New York, Swank apartment, Lionel got by a 20-story French window with a listen to his Lester clarinet solo on Way Down Yonder in New Orleans, other side. sunk to hear an Englishman discovering the greatness of America in a single Negro musician. Lester is just like the river. The river starts in near Butte, Montana, in frozen snowcaps, three forks, and meanders on down across states and entire territorial areas of dun bleak land with hawthorn crackling in the sleet, picks up rivers at Bismarck, Omaha, and St. Louis just north, another Cairo, another Arkansas, Tennessee comes deluging on New Orleans with muddy news from the land and a lure of subterranean excitement that's like the vibration of the entire land sucked of its gut in mad midnight, fevered hot, the big mud hole rank, claw-poled, frogular, pawed-soled Titanic Mississippi from the north, full of wires and cold wood and horn. So Lester began holding his horn high in nigger chicken shacks. Backstreet Basie Casey wearing greasy smeared corduroy big pants and torn flap smoking jacket without straw, scuffle up shoes, all sloppy Mother Hubbard, soft pudding, and key ring, early handkerchiefs, hands up, arms up, horn horizontal, shining dull and wood brown shithouse with ammoniac piss from broken gut bottles around, shitty pukey bowl and a whore sprawled in it, legs spread in a brown cotton stockings, bleeding at belted mouth, moaning, yes, it's as Lester horn placed. Has started blowing, blow for me, old motherfucker, blow. 1938, it's 1938. Miles is still on his daddy's checkered knee. Lewis has only got 20 years behind him, and Lester blows all Kansas City to ecstasy, and now Americans from coast to go mad and fall by, and everybody's picking up. What? This had no effect on Cody? He who stood beside me, listening to Lester's children in Chicago, he who hung in the doorway waiting for his connection, with me drag millionaires to hear Lester. Dig him, Cody says with a sneer when we see Lester, just after Chicago, just before Mexico City at Birdland, and Lester sneers at him from the bandstand. This is the mark of the hip generation. I'm hip. Man, I'm hip. Flying back across the fantastic land, thus did Cody in his climaxes, and in the nighttime traveling, worried, look ahead, gnawing, climatic, dolorous, thus did Cody. He's connected with Lester. All our horns came down. Tragic mewling cat on screechy hinky fence by cotton cloth and pin. In his rapist period, Lester had let his horn half down and his head, consequently, because he didn't adjust mouthpiece, fell over 90 degrees in sadness. Then finally, in his baroque late hornings in the open void of American nightclub, he let the horn fall all the way, adjusted the mouthpiece only in relation to the first fall, and hangs there. 90 degrees, large face, sad, blowing cliches in a masterful and cool manner. His hair long, his forearm busted. His shoes thick and crimson rich now, like chemical milk foam plastic rubber couches. Instead of his old galoshes of his carton, born 30 years too soon, young manhood in shacks. Oh, Lester, great name. I, much like him, incline and do fall. I've given up just about like Lester, you'd say, but of course, but yes, that's apt. He sure could blow. Of course, it's just music. I don't get frantic about music anymore, of course. Only the criticism in my mind. Cody talking, stern, boned in a fixity pose, solid rock, the canny Scott Old Yates, a future Dostoevsky of inflexible, tragic convictions and irritability. Some generation. Some nigger. And that big void over the beloved bending head of the earth. God bless us all.
All Broadway musicals sound the same, especially the baritones.
Hello, Steve. Hello, Don. Say, Bill, what's that, Freddy? I've never, never been in love. Do you know something? I've never been in love either. How do you know when you're really in love? I don't know. Well, it's a certain intangible thing, my friend, you see. I've never been in love before. I never knew the score.
Genius! Einlein booked the numbers, didn't need paper or pencil. Now the nigga can't remember who he is. Say, nigga, get your ass out the street, boy! Move out the way, boy!
Ah.
What's happening?
What's
happening. Shit, I know something happening, cause everything's moving. Baby. Hey, Potter! Come on, old motherfucker. Dust your ass off, baby. Hey, Pops, you got anything on do? Straight me out there. Yeah, nigga, I got something for your ass. Got some advice. You better lay off that narcotic, nigga. That shit done made you null and void. I ain't lying, boy. What's wrong with you? Why don't you straighten up and get a job? Get a job! I'm a license plate pressing motherfucker, too, baby. Shoot. Where a nigga gonna get a job out here pressing license plates? Pop! Nigga, listen to me. Don't you hit me no more, boy. I'll dust your old junky ass off. You know I will, nigga. You all right with me, boy. I'm just ashamed to see you like that. Shame to see me. What about this shit out here? Niggas is fucking with me, man. Was I finished? I went to the unemployment bureau, baby. Bitch sitting behind the desk. Holy motherfucker. Come tell me, come on. You have a criminal record. I said, I know that, bitch. I'm a criminal. Just tell me why I won't get a job. Ugly bitch. I seen your better faces on iodine bottles. This made me mad, yeah. I vomited this shit on the floor. I did, man. Then make that nigga with that pistol down there clean it up. Nigga talking about, clean up that vomit, motherfucker. I said, fuck you, nigga. I ain't clean that shit up. You see, he don't clean that shit up. I shoot your ass. I said, well, who gonna clean up the blood, nigga? Went outside, man. I was cleaning a broke big dog, too, baby. Saw a bitch was so fine. Woo! Shot bolts through my heart, baby.
Nigga, you wouldn't know a fine woman if you tripped over.
This bitch was fine, but I ain't man. Bitch was so fine, I wanted to suck her daddy's dick. Is that fine enough for your ass? Ambush. I went home. My dear called me a dog. You dig that? My father said, he don't want to see me in the vicinity. Just cause I stole his television. That's the politics, baby. I'm sick, Pop. Wanna, can you help me? My mind's thinking about shit I don't wanna think about. I can't stop the motherfucker, baby. Moving to grass for the kid. Tell me some of that old lies of yours to make me stop thinking about the truth. Would you help me?
Yeah, I'm gonna help you, boy. Cause I believe you got potential. That's right. You don't know how to deal with the white man, that's your problem. I know how to deal with him. That's right, that's why I'm in the position. That's right, that's why I'm in the position. That's right, that's why I'm in the position I'm in today.
Thank you very much. Good night.
From QOX on the road. There were earlier days in Denver when Dean had everybody sit in the dark, the girls and
just talk with a voice that was once hypnotic and strange, and was said to make the girls come across by sheer force of persuasion and the content of what he said. This was when he was 15 or 16. Now his disciples were married, and wives of his disciples had him on the carpet for the sexuality and the life he had helped bring into being. I listened further. Now you're going east with Sal, the lady said. What do you think you're going to accomplish by that? Camille has to stay home and mind the baby. Now you're gone, how could she keep her job? She never wants to see you again, and I don't blame her. And if you see Ed along the road, you tell him to come back to me or I'll kill him. Just as flat as that, it was as sad as night. I felt as if I was with strange brothers and sisters in a pitiful dream. Then a complete silence fell over everybody. Where once Dean would have talked his way out, he now fell silent himself, but standing in front of everybody, ragged and broken and idiotic, right under the light bulbs, bony, mad face covered with sweat and throbbing veins, saying, yes, 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 as though tremendous revelations were pouring into him all the time now, and I'm convinced they were. And the others suspected as much and were frightened. He was beef, the root, the soul of beatific. What was he knowing? He tried all in his power to tell me what he was knowing. They envied that about me, my position at his side, defending him and drinking him in as they once tried to do. Then they looked at me. What was I, a stranger, doing on the West Coast this fair night? We're going to Italy, I said. I washed my hands, the whole matter. Then there was a strange sense of maternal satisfaction in the air, for the girls were really looking at Dean the way a mother looks at the dearest and most errant child. He, with his sad thumb and all his revelations, knew it well, and that was why he was able, in tick-tocking silence, to walk out of the apartment without a word, to wait for us downstairs as soon as we'd made up our minds about time. This was what we sensed about the ghost on the sidewalk. I looked out the window. He was alone in the doorway, digging the street. Bitterness, recriminations, advice, morality, sadness, everything was behind him. And ahead of him was the ragged and ecstatic joy of pure being. Come on, Galatea. Marie, let's go hit the jazz joints and forget it. Dean will be dead someday. Then what can you say to him? The sooner he's dead, the better, she said. She spoke officially for everyone in the room. Almost everyone. Very well, then, I said, but now he's alive, and I'll bet you want to know what he does next, and that's because he's got the secret that we're all busting to find, and it's splitting his head wide open, and if he goes mad, don't worry, it won't be your fault, but the fault of God. They objected to this. They said I really didn't know Dean. They said he was the worst scoundrel that ever lived, and I'd find out someday, to my regret. I was amused to hear them protest so much. Roy Johnson rose to the defense of the ladies and said he knew Dean better than anybody, and all Dean was just a very interesting, even amusing con man. I went out to find Dean, and we had a brief talk about it. Oh, man, don't worry. Everything is perfect and fine. He was rubbing his belly and licking his lips.
Let's pose our first question to the professor. Professor, where did man come from?
Man came from the earth. Man was begat by raindrops, grew out of the ground, uprooted himself, and just walked away. Man was first a stump. After man pulled himself away from the earth, man went walking, dragging, of course, the roots, leaving little seeds as he walked along, giving growth to other vegetation and creating more man trees, as they were known in the early times.
Isn't it true, though, however, may I just say something here? Yes, you may, Reverend. That God created man after himself.
That's not true. That's a falsehood. God created himself after himself. Man created himself after God, after he found out who he was. See, God was a person from another place. He came here on earth and liked the place and decided he'd settle down. Knew he'd make a fortune here. He's been cleaning up every Sunday for the last thousands of years with that religion crap.
And we all know it's patootie patootie. Don't we know that?
I got something to say, man. You dig? I mean, you cats been up here rapping and ain't said nothing about the real thing. You know what I mean? I got something to say, man. Man, the black man, the real soul brother, first was coming by himself. He wasn't no tree. I mean, I don't want to hear it, man. You cats up here rapping about the Jews, but what about me, man? What about my people?
I don't believe anyone said anything about the Jews.
You will. You will.
Maybe Miss Dumtree'd like to say something.
Yes. I'd like to say, since I gave up narcotics, I found God.
I beg to differ. I don't see the tie-in between narcotics and God.
God was a junkie, baby. Now, he had to be a junkie to put up with all this, you know what I mean? You don't just walk around feeling nothing behind all this is going on, man. Yes, the Reverend, he'll tell you about it. Tell him about Rev, because me and Rev was rapping backstage. I know where it's at. Keep going, Rev, rapping.
Well, my friend here probably is right. God probably did take some sort of outside medication. As it states in chapter 6, verse 32, I will take unto myself what is needed. God didn't want us to have it. I don't think he would have created it. Amen. I disagree. I think the devil had a lot to do with this. I think the devil has been man's greatest curse since time began. I think the devil created time. The devil created time. We have proof of this. We found a watch. That's right, a watch. Primitive, but nevertheless a watch. And head on in the back to devil with it all. What do you say to that?
Wow, man, what's that got to do with the real thing? Everybody know who the devil is. The devil's white. Because if he wasn't white, he wouldn't be right. You dig? Now, I got something to say about it all. I study religion, you know what I mean? Organized religion. And there ain't no such thing, because God ain't never dug too many people. He just dug a few cats. Like Moses. Yeah. That's the only cat he ever rapped to. Him and Jesus, you did? He didn't dig no whole lot of people. You cats coming on with the organized religion like God dig a whole bunch of people. Unreal. And I ain't going for it.
I would like to say something. To my friend here, when God touches one of us, he's not just touching one of us, but he touches many of us in many ways. Often God touches me at night. I lay in bed and I feel God touching me. Quite marvelous. Well, that about concludes it for tonight, friends.
This is from the newly published book that he showed me in the New Yorker magazine, Letters on Cézanne by Rilke. It's got a bright blue cover with a picture of Cézanne being some apples. Couple bottles on the table in the corner of the room. Truly, all art is a result, Rilke writes from Paris. If you June 24th, 1907, to his wife. Surely all art is the result of one's having been in danger, of having gone through an experience all the way to the end, to where no one can go any further. The further one goes, the more private, the more personal, the more singular an experience becomes, and the thing one is making is finally the necessary, irrepressible, and nearly as possible definite utterance of this singularity. Therein lies the enormous aid the work of art brings to the life of the one who must make it. That it is his epitome, the knot in the rosary at which his life recites a prayer. The ever-returning proof to himself of his unity and genuineness, which presents itself only to him while appearing anonymous to the outside, nameless, existing merely as necessity, as reality, as being. Mother, daughter. Van Gogh could perhaps lose his composure, but behind it there was always his work. He could no longer lose that. And Rodin, when he's not feeling well, is close to his work. He writes beautiful things on countless pieces of paper, reads Plato, follows him in his thought. But it's not that this is just the result of discipline or compulsion. It's all joy. It's natural well-being and the one thing that surpasses everything else. Perhaps one has to have a clearer insight into the nature of one's task, get a more tangible hold on it, and realize it in 100 details. I believe I do feel what Van Gogh must have felt at a certain juncture. And it's a strong and great feeling that everything is yet to be done, everything. But this devotion to what is nearest, this is something I can't do as yet, or only in my best moments, while it is at one's worst moments that one really needs it. Van Gogh could paint the inside of a hospital, and in his most anxious days he painted the most disquieting objects. How else could he have survived? This is what has to be attained. And I have a feeling it can't be forced. It must come out of insight, from pleasure, from no longer being able to postpone the work in view of all the many things that have to be done. If only one did not have comforting memories of time spent without working. Memories of lying still and taking comfort. Memories of hours spent in simple waiting or leafing through old illustrations or reading some novel or other. And heaps of memories like these all the way back to childhood. Mother letter, October 1907, from Paris. Today I wanted to tell you a little about Cézanne. With regard to his work habits, he claimed to have lived as a bohemian until his 40th year. Only then, through his acquaintance with Pizarro, did he develop a taste for work. But then to such an extent that for the next 30 years he did nothing but work. Actually, without joy, it seems, in a constant rage, in conflict with every single one of his paintings, none of which seemed to achieve what he considered to be the indispensable thing, la réalisation, he called it. And he found it in the Venetians, whom he had seen over and over again, in the Louvre, and to whom he had given his unreserved recognition. To achieve the conviction and substantiality of things, a reality intensified and potentiated to the point of indestructibility by his experience of the object. This seemed to him to be the purpose of his innermost work. Old, sick, exhausted every evening, to the edge of collapse by the regular course of the day's work, often he would go to bed at 6, before dark, after a senselessly ingested meal. Angry, distrustful, ridiculed, but mocked and mistreated each time he went to his studio, but celebrating Sunday, attending Mass and Vespers, as he had in his childhood, and very politely requesting some slightly better food from Madame Bremond, his housekeeper, hoping nevertheless from day to day that he might reach that achievement which he felt was the only thing that mattered, and all the while assuming one can trust the testimony of a not very likable painter. Rilke here refers to Emile Bernard, who associated with everyone for a while. He exacerbated the difficulty of his work in the most willful manner. While painting a landscape or still life, he would conscientiously persevere in front of the object, but approach it only by a very complicated detour. Beginning with the darkest tones, he would cover their depths with a layer of color that led a little beyond them, and keep going, expanding outward from color to color until gradually he reached another contrasting pictorial element. where, beginning at a new center, you would proceed in a similar way. I think there was a conflict, a mutual struggle between the two procedures of first looking and confidently receiving, and then of appropriated and making personal use of what has been received. That the two, perhaps as a result of becoming conscious, would immediately start opposing each other, talking out loud, as it were, and going on perpetually interrupting and contradicting each other. And the old man endured their discord and ran back and forth in his studio, which was badly lit because the builder had not found it necessary to pay attention to this strange old bird whom the people had agreed not to take seriously. He ran back and forth in his studio with green apples scattered about, or went into his garden in despair and sat, and before him lay the small town, unsuspecting, with its cathedral, a town for decent and modest burghers, while he, just as his father, who was a hat maker, had foreseen, had become different, a bohemian. That's how his father saw it, and what he himself believed. This father, knowing that bohemians live and die in misery, had determined to work for the son, had become a kind of small banker to whom people brought their money, just because he was honest, Cezanne said. And it was thanks to these financial precautions that Cezanne later had the means to continue painting without interruption. Perhaps he went to his father's funeral. He loved his mother too, but when she was buried, he wasn't there. He was engaged sur le motif, as he called it. That's how important work for him was already, and he couldn't afford to make an exception, not even this one, which must surely have commended itself to his piety and simplicity as an important occasion. He became well known in Paris, and gradually his fame grew, but he had nothing but mistrust for any progress that wasn't of his own making, that others had made for him, quite aside from the question of how they made it. He remembered only too well, and how thoroughly Zola, a fellow provincial like himself and a close acquaintance since early childhood, had misinterpreted his fate and his aspirations in Louvre, the masterpiece. When a visitor in the middle of a meal described a novel about the unknown masterpiece, book of Balzac. Balzac, with unbelievable foresight of future development, invents a painter named Fraunhofer who is destroyed by the discovery that there really are no contours, but only oscillating transitions. Destroyed, that is, by an impossible problem. The old man, hearing this, stands up, despite Madame Bremond, who surely did not appreciate this kind of irregularity, and voiceless with agitation, points his finger clearly again and again at himself, painful though that may have been. Zola had understood nothing. It was Balzac who had foreseen or forefelt that in painting you can suddenly come upon something so huge that no one can deal with it. Cezanne generally reminds one of Rodin in his statements. For example, when he complains about the way his old city is being destroyed and disfigured every day. The only difference is that where Rodin, with his great self-confident equilibrium, comes out with a matter-of-fact remark, Cezanne, sick and old and isolated, is seized by a rage. Coming home in the evening, he'll start boiling up over some change and work himself into a fury, and finally noticing how it exhausts him to be so angry, he'll promise himself, I'll stay home. Work, just work, nothing else.
Did Master Jim send for me? Heard he wanted me to shoe his horse? Put a little horse shoe? Yeah, I want you to shoe my paw's horse. This here's my paw.
Right over, boy. Don't touch me.
Okay, boss. Where's the horse at?
Stop back by the outhouse.
Okie dokie.
See y'all down the lawn.
Oh, hello.
Howdy, ma'am. Where's the horse? Boogity boogity.
Oh, it's over there. My, you have some lovely biceps.
Thank you, ma'am. Would you like to feel my ass?
There's another letter from 1907, October. Today I went to see his pictures again. And it's remarkable what an environment they create without looking at a particular one. Standing in the middle between the two rooms, one feels their presence drawing together into a colossal reality, as if these colors could heal one of indecision once and for all. The good conscience of these reds, these blues, their simple truthfulness, educates you, and if you stand beneath them as acceptingly as possible, it's as if they were doing something for you. You also notice a little more clearly each time how necessary it was to go beyond love, too. It's natural, after all, to love each of the things as one makes it, but if one shows this, one makes it less well. One judges it instead of saying it. One ceases to be impartial, and the very best, love, stays outside the work, doesn't enter into it. It's left aside, untranslated. That's how the painting of sentiments came about, which is no better than to paint things. They'd paint, I love this here, instead of painting, here it is, in which case everyone must see for himself whether or not I loved it. This isn't shown at all, and some would even insist that love has nothing to do with it. It's that thoroughly exhausted in the action of making. There is no residue. It may be that this emptying out of love in anonymous work, which produces such pure things, was never achieved as completely as in the work of this old man. His inner nature, having grown mistrustful and crossed, helped him to do it. He certainly would not have shown another human this kind of love, had he been forced to conceive such a love, but with this disposition, which was completely developed now, thanks to his reclusive eccentricity, he now turned to nature and knew how to swallow back his love for every apple and put it to rest in the painted apple forever. Can you imagine what that is like? And what's it like to experience this through him?
Send in the new boy! Hello, Sonny, how are you? My name... And we got a nice band here, just like one big family. They're going to have a nice tour here. The agency sent you over, Mr. Glazer, and told me you'd be perfect boy for my band. You're deaf. All right, you got a nice face there, and we're going to go right on the road. How come you don't talk to me, Sonny?
Like an old man, a few stab gas and all. I got really good eyes to make it, sweetie, you know. A lot of cats put you down, Mr. No matter what they say, man, you're the best banjo player. Whatever your axe is, I know you swing, you know. That's the main thing, to swing of the axe, you know. Like, I knew Bird very well, man. I got Bird's axe, you know. I saw a Bird, man. He was really tore up the last time. I knew all them people, I knew Miles. I knew Basie for Kid County, in a wild. Okay, you know. So like, really, if you want to do the thing, baby, like you dig.
What the hell you talking about?
Hey, really, be pretty wild. Hey, I don't want to bug you, but, can I get a little bread in front?
You're hungry? You want a sandwich?
No, and I have some money. I need. I'm really. Better get to know me, man. I'm really a good-natured slob, man. I really give everything away to people, and you know, I even gave my bed away. That's why I'm sleeping. And I need some money just to take my aunt to the hospital. You know. Hey, well, let's do the thing, baby. You know? You got eyes to make it, you know.
All right, I'm going to sign you. Because I'm good judge of character.